Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Jules Gill, there's a whole bunch of new music out in the world, and we've got a question for one of the finest bands on the planet.
I was about to say, you said to me, you promised me before we started this podcast, oh, don't worry, Jules, I'm not going to open by talking about that band.
I'm not going to open on away. It. I'm just teasing it. I'm teasing who we're going to talk about.
I don't even know ABBA. What we're doing, mate. What are we doing?
We're doing the entire band of podcast, the entitled UBP. ABBA podcast. The UBP. I'm Scott Tilford, joined by Jules Gill.
Hello, everyone.
A very messy podcast because we rounded up a whole bunch of questions. Lots of people sent us stuff in last week. I asked for a lot of people's hot takes this week, so we've got some nice opinionated stuff. Also, you've frozen. You've frozen, Jules.
I'm not frozen. I'm still alive, mate. I'm still very much here. I've not frozen. The only thing that has frozen is my heart after realizing seeing your face again after like having that lovely moment when we connected in the office. We got to record the UBP live together. That was really, really fun. And now we're back here in Zoom land.
We're back in, we're back in Zoomville. We had a lovely time last week eating some pies. Sounds sexual. It's not actual pies. It was lovely in big pines and stuff. But anyway, thanks to everybody for sending in their various questions and thoughts. We'll get to as many as we can. Opening question from Dan, who says, what's your take on Square Enix attempting to blame the Avengers failure on Crystal Dynamics? Can they really be that tone deaf to the fan base? Appreciate all the work, lads, and hope you're both well. Have you caught up with this so far?
So what I was a bit disappointed to hear is that I don't like it when you get companies that backtrack on their games. It's the Peter Molyneux sort of thing when he was doing
Sony
Fable.
In the run-up for
Fable 2, he was like denouncing Fable 1, saying it was a piece of crap and that you should play Fable 2. It's much better. And then when Fable 2, 3 came out, he was like, oh, Fable 2 was rubbish. I can't believe that I even sold you on that. Oh, what a muggins I am.
What am I like?
That's what it feels with this, because they've gone, the Avengers has been out for a year now, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Like, it's been out for a long old time. The complaints have been pretty like substantial and consistent throughout all of the events and throughout everything that's going on. And Square Enix haven't shied away from pushing from all of their microtransaction heavy thing, all of the event stuff that's come out. They haven't stopped with that. So they've clearly been ignoring the feedback just so that they could get to this point and be like, ah, actually it wasn't as good, we've made you pay for it, but you know,
Dan says here, it's like, can they really be that tone deaf? I mean, the thing is, it would be entirely Square Enix whose decision it was to put all these money grubby things in the game in the first place. These are the people who wanted the microtransaction elements put into Deus Ex. They mandated that weird half multiplayer mode that was in Mankind Divided. So at no point do I think it's Crystal Dynamics' fault, and I think it is really lame to just try and throw them under the bus and be like, oh, actually they weren't the right decision. It's like, well, if you stepped away and just let them make a video game, because I'm sure in the press release thing they mentioned that they were known for Tomb Raider and they've made other games over the years, and it's like, yes, yeah, so they are a competent studio.
Tomb Raider, as far as I can tell, didn't have the focus. Like, I mean, yes, it did have a shoehorn multiplayer system in it, but at nowhere were those games ever sold to us as being like piecemeal with tons of DLC added to it. It was basically like, here's a standalone single player game first, and then additional content gets dropped later on.
It's kind of funny, like, you can almost read it in reverse, where I wonder if the statement that they were putting out was actually saying that they wanted a studio that would be as money grubby as them. So they were saying, you can read it as them saying, well, we should have got someone more akin to like an EA type studio or someone like that, because we wanted all that money, and Crystal Dynamics had too much integrity, and that balancing act was what broke everything.
Doesn't it feel a lot like the EA BioWare Anthem debacle from just a couple of years ago? This seems exactly the same like treads that we're doing, because it's just like a big publisher who wants a lot of money, gets in a well-known developer to make them a game, promises the world based on their lineage, and then when it doesn't deliver in the right ways because it's twisted what that developer does into something that is what the publisher wants, they then just go, we'll wipe our hands clean of it, and it's BioWare's reputation that's been sullied in the process.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, no one looks, and I'm sorry, Mr. Square Enix, if you are listening to this, it's not a personal Enix. Attack on you. I'm just saying that, like, if you've got your EAs, your Ubisofts, your Square Enix, nobody looks at the big publishers and thinks, oh, they're swell guys. No one thinks that. They look at the developers and go, they are the people that are working their asses off for their publisher overlords. Like, it's not the EAs and the Ubisofts that are walking away from these situations going, oh no, my integrity has been irreparably damaged. No, it's the publisher that then goes off and the developer that goes off and then has to work even harder to regain that foothold of trust within the community.
Yeah, no, man, entirely. I think that there was that whole thing that just happened with Hangar 13 as well, the Mafia 3 developers, that they just had a game that was cancelled after 4 to 5 years. And it just, I always feel for the developers. It's not like there aren't any someone in that developing house might be a bit more money focused than, you know, others, the coding department, for example, or the art department, but it is nearly always the publisher whims that result in money grubby stuff overall.
There is one thing, though, that I did think of just now. If you are being approached by a publisher, or you are approaching a publisher with a concept for a game, maybe you need to, in this day and age, have in your business model, like, all of these microtransaction heavy stuff, all of these ways that are like paying in different forms and just getting as much monetary content out of this as possible. So maybe when they approached it, Crystal Dynamics had to be like, listen, we want the Avengers license. This is what we're prepared to do for it. Maybe they did agree in principle to have this shell of a game forced upon them, but to then say that it's their fault, when in actuality, it's the industry's fault for forcing these types of games into every single, this format of video games, into every single genre.
Honestly,
you can't escape this now.
No, and I think I've said this before, but I think gamers are some of the most learned learned fans in any entertainment medium. Like, we know what's up. Everyone has a game playing friend. Even if you're a more casual player, you have that friend who knows everything inside out. And hence why things like Anthem bomb and the Avengers bombed, because it was very plain to see that people were being abused in regards to their money and everything. So I think if everyone sees right through this, and I think that it is a hell of a tone deaf thing to say. Hopefully, in the long run, people know that the quality of the developers, and Crystal Dynamics have made some phenomenal games over the years, whereas Square Enix have been a bit all over the place, especially with their publishing decisions. Next question from Matthew McGowan. My hot take is that Mass Effect 1 is the best in the series. 2 and 3 are cover shooters. 1 is actually an RPG.
Okay.
They removed the healing system, added ammo clips, way less powers and abilities to choose or upgrade, no weapon or ammo upgrades. What do you think, Jules?
Now, this is a classic troll move right now, clearly, because this is the thing, my friend. You are allowed to like Mass Effect 1. It is not a bad game by any stretch of the imagination. It definitely does have some rough around the edges things, but Mass Effect 2, it scaled things back and improved things in so many ways. Yes,
the shooting's way better.
Yes, it has like a cover shooter focus, but that's not a bad thing. That is like, that actually helped the flow of the gameplay battles. The amount of times in Mass Effect 1 where you would be trying to maneuver around cover and trying to manage your squad and things just were just not working, it made me feel like an absolute idiot. Whereas in Mass Effect 2, they're having that slowdown when you bring up the powers, using all these like cover things to buy yourself that little bit of time, meant that you could then wait until the enemy gets into position and launch a perfect counterattack that made you feel like the true commander chef that you were meant to be playing as.
All the shortcuts as well, so you can just like fire off your squad mates' abilities.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Exactly.
You can take on stuff. Tell you what, Jules Gill, going through the Mass Effect Legendary Edition, I might side with Matthew McGowan here. I actually really loved. I think it's because if you go through the Legendary,
it's the best Mass Effect.
For me personally, and I adore Mass Effect 2, it was one of my top three favorite games until I went back through the trilogy again on the Legendary Edition. I love and prefer the feel of Mass Effect 1. It's way more like Star Trek, it's way more open-ended. I love the fact that you're being a Spectre and you get to go planet to planet. You have all these different interactions with all these different races, and it feels more open. The thing you said about 2 reducing the scope is the reason I prefer 1, and 1's tone. I just love the squad. The things that I loved about 2 at the time are the things that put me off now, which which is the whole that he dies at the beginning, and like it reduces the scope of the story and your agency in that world. You don't get to be a Spectre anymore. It's less about humanity on the intergalactic stage. It's things I loved about the first one.
But see, my argument is that it's the first Mass Effect. It's like a shotgun. It hits you with so many things in like a scattershot approach of like, here's this amazing like new race. Here's this amazing new planet. It trades on wonder of you not seeing it for the first time. It's that Star Wars experience of just being like, whoa, this is amazing. But Mass Effect 2 is like a sniper rifle. It knows exactly what it's aiming for and it hits it. And it's not about you. It's not about Commander Shepard. It's about the entirety of the human race and beyond. It's about the personal connections you make with all of your team across the way. And it becomes like, an emotive story that maybe it's not as cool as being a Spectre. Maybe you're right. You can't be the James Bond of space, but this is a much more personal tale in Mass Effect 2. And I loved all of the character development that comes with it. It's a stronger, it's maybe less of an impressive story, Mass Effect 2, but it is much more of an impactful one from my opinion.
When I played it in 2011, I would completely agree with you. It's weird when I went back through it. I was like, Mass Effect 1 has this great drive. Like I said, you're the first human Spectre. You're on the intergalactic stage and you're up against all these other aliens and all these different conversations and philosophies about what you represent to the galaxy. And then 2 is this like side story. It's like a Gaiden story. It's just sort of the collectors don't really matter. They bring them back in, but it's like, we're going to do this whole side thing of like him dying and everyone like losing trust in him and whatever. And it's just weird when you play them back to back, that feels like you're being taken out of the main drive that you had from the first game. And I didn't feel that at the time because we had years in between those.
Yeah, those years. Yeah.
But if you play it as a solid trilogy, if you binge the Mass Effect trilogy, which I did when the Legendary Edition came out, 2 feels like they're taking you away from the thrust of the first game. And that's also its biggest strength if you love that side story. But for me, it made me prefer the original.
But for me, it cut out all of the fat that Mass Effect 1 carried around with it. Like, let's face it, the combat was a bit ropey. I'm sure that the Legendary Edition is fixed. Yeah, I'm sure that it's like fixed a lot of it for that and it's made it a lot better. But it's the thing that I hated the Mako. This blows my mind, by the way, that there are so many people out there that are just like, oh, you know what's really cool? Driving a dinky little like tub around that I can fling off a cliff and no one inside seems to bother. Does it have some sort of like anti-gravity inside it that no one's getting their like concussed every single time you go over a rock? I hate the design of that thing. It literally looks like something you knock up after watching Blue Peter from a different room. Like,
I'm following
the guide. Oh, just get a Pringles tube and slap some wheels on it.
You're not wrong that it is just like a sort of a cigarette packet falling down a hill. It's not you're not wrong. If you went down the realistic or the tone maintaining sense, it does break everything because everybody would die inside that thing. But I do love controlling it, and also like I said, it factors into that whole idea of getting in the Normandy. You get the Normandy for the first time, the ship, and you're charting these different planets. There's a real galaxy-sized feel to Mass Effect 1. And literally, you can argue that it breaks when you realize how many different biomes are repeated or how many different parts of environments are repeated.
Because they're just so empty all the time. See, I felt like empty padding like in a lot of places. There was only a few notable exceptions where I was like, this is actually feels like I'm on the first person to step foot on this land sort of thing. But there's one area that I will admit gets me every time. And that is where you go to like, there's a shifty cow. Do you remember this? I sound like I've just bent over and just did a big fart on the mic, but I am not talking guff. Like, it is, you go to an area, right? And it's like this quadruped thing, and it's just kind of like it's like walking along, and it's like it has shifty something on it, and it's like when you turn around, it steals your credits.
Okay.
No, I'm not making it up. I've got to Google this. I've got like, okay. I know I sound like I'm a madman.
Depending on how this wraps back around, this backs up my idea that, because you never know what you're going to get on those planets. And as much as you can say that different parts are copied and pasted, it's the feeling. For me, it's that Isaac Asimov, No Man's Sky, big open space sci-fi feeling. That's the reason that I love it so much. And so if you can touch down on a variety of planets, you know, just by de facto, they are different planets.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing that I like so much. And finding a diseased, crazy cow is maybe one of the best things about it.
So I found the thing that I was looking for. It's called a shifty looking cow, and it's a space cow that is found on the planet Ontarom in the Newton system of the Kepler Verge. Now, what you do is that...
I mean, how
cool
was that sentence, though?
I know, but when you turn around, the cow promptly begins stealing the Spectre's credits slowly and will even follow the commander around.
I wonder if that's a reference to Diablo and the crazy cows that were like Diablo 1 or 2 or whatever it was, the cow maybe? Glitch.
It's very strange. And I remember just like coming along and just being like, what is this? But yeah, never fails to impress me that.
See, that thing, like I said, that's the essence of why I love it. Like, I don't want a whole planet full of, you know, credit stealing cows, but the fact that you don't know what you're going to get is that feeling of sci-fi, quintessential sci-fi in Mass Effect 1. Like, if you go back to Mass Effect 1 now, obviously play the Legendary Edition if you have a choice. As soon as that music kicks in, those really slow bedded synths that just, it's just like, oh, this is a style of sci-fi that 2 got away from. And it's fine. 2 does that other style of sci-fi immaculately, the more sort of, you know, like Thieves Guild, merchant smugglers style sci-fi. It does that so well. But there's something about 1 where I do, at the minute, having been through the trilogy very recently, I do love 1 the most. And I didn't used to. For the last 10 years, it was 2. But I would encourage people to go play Mass Effect 1, see what they think, carry this on. We might do a whole podcast on Mass Effect 1 versus 2. You never know. Next question from Pinky, Dan the Liberal Doorman, says, for Limp Bizkit, I'm totally Team Sonic the Tailfoot over Grumpy Dr. Egg Daddy. The new album is exactly what I wanted from a Limp Bizkit album. Also, he tweeted this while having a snacky poo. Now, that sounds worse than it is. A snacky poo Limp Bizkit context is a bag of crisps or possibly a bag of biscuits. Carry on.
He's taken a snacky poo of an opinion right here, because this right, I listened to it twice, the full album, all the way through, and I was like,
"This is the new Limp Bizkit album called Still Sucks." If anyone wants to listen to the new Limp Bizkit album, it's very good.
I didn't want to basically judge it just off a first opinion. I went back through and listened to it again, and I will admit, the first 2 or 3 songs, they are old school Limp Bizkit, unashamed bangers. Really, really enjoyed.
Rotten Biscuit.
Utterly dumb they are. Like there is nothing going on in those songs that you haven't heard before. But that's not necessarily a bad thing when you're considering how much of a living meme that Fred Durst is. However.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When they started doing the ballad, the first one made my skin invert, mate. It felt like my bones leapt out of my back because it did not want to be a part of this body anymore. And then the second ballad, the slow bit that they do, where it leads into the heavier screaming bits of the chorus, I was like, this is even worse, because they're making me sit through somebody pulling out my nails and pouring lemon juice in there, and then they're hitting me in the face with what sounds like shocking a terrier in the testicles with one of those shock prods.
I love Limp Bizkit. I grew up with them. I have that big nostalgic pull. Don't shake your head at me.
I grew up with them too. But you can't love that ballad. That ballad is the worst piece of music I've ever heard.
When I was growing up, loved their cover of Beyond Blue Eyes or whatever it's called, Behind Blue Eyes. But I'm not. Limp Bizkit have always done ballads. They've always done slower stuff. They did that song called Why on the Greatest Hits.
Right, okay. I'll tell you this much, mate. When's the last time you actually listened to one of those without a choice? Never.
Oh, like yesterday. Never. All the time.
No, you did not load up Spotify and say, Spotify, show me some Limp Bizkit ballads. Let's slow it way down.
Limp Bizkit do really good ballads. I'm throwing it out there. We'll get some sort of comment thread going forward. Chicken your head. I'll make a tweet with the best Limp Bizkit ballads, and I might do a poll, and we'll see what people think of the LBP. The Limp Bizkit ballads, because it's a whole side genre.
It's blowing my mind. But you know what? Apart from that, thing. Snacky Poo is hilarious. I have to admit, that got me good, that one.
I like that he made a song about just having a bag of crisps or a bunch of biscuits. He just wants a snacky poo.
I have to admit, I did enjoy the fact that he's taken how many years since their last album?
9, I believe.
So 9 years a out while. Of the game.
Yeah.
So 9 years out of the game, right? He's traded on his thing and he's come back and he's just gone, oh, what should we do for this new album? Should we hire an artist maybe with more than 50 quid to spend on the front cover? Nah, I'll draw myself an MS Paint, mate.
They got DJ Lethal back.
They got him back, but he doesn't seem to appear on half of the songs. He only mentions him. He's like, DJ Lethal's here, and he does something amazing, and then he just disappears for the rest of the album.
Apparently, DJ Lethal, Donald Johnson Lethal, was the reason that they managed to do a new album at all. He was the one that got the whole band back together again. So I am going to read some lyrics, very quick lyrics from Snacky Poo, who says, Lethal, turn it up, we burning up the kitchen. Freddie D going to whip us up a batch you ain't forgetting. I'm bringing out the fixings too many to mention, and bringing back the 90s to ease up on the tension. Now, I don't know what you can do with that other than just be happy.
Well, I tell you what you can do. You can call it a day after half an hour's hard work is what you can do with that one, because that was a first draft if ever I've heard one.
I love
He was on notes, right? Yes. On his little phone. He was just like typing away for a bit and he's like, attention. Yeah, that'll do. Flush the toilet. Snacky Poo. Oh, yeah.
Oh my God, it's the best. They have a song called Barnacle that's just a full-on Nirvana ripoff, and a song called Goodbye that's a Westlife ripoff. So just dive in, have a bit of swim. It's a lovely time. Know that Jules is shaking his head in utter disdain, but I am not. I love that
drown
album.
Me,
anyway,
drown me.
Album of the year. Next question by RB.
You cannot get away. I'm sorry, mate. I'm not letting you pass on to the next question by saying album of the year after that. Repeat, this is not an endorsement for Limp Bizkit Still Sucks being album of the year.
It is by me. It's the most fun I've had with an album all year. Anyway, next question by RB, who says, hi lads, thanks for the great podcasting. Don't know if it will be after the conversation we just had. Why do you think people are so surprised when a story-heavy game like Guardians of the Galaxy comes out and is actually good? Am I alone in thinking that there is still a place for single-player story experiences? I think that this is entirely because it was Guardians, it was the follow-up to the Avengers. It had nothing to do with it being a single-player game.
I think that I agree with you on that one. Also, the marketing itself seemed to suggest that it was trading on the Avengers. Lineage is kind of just like holding up a used doormat that's just somebody want their like absolute dog turd covered boots on, just saying, look at that. That's mm-hmm. pretty impressive. And it put that on the fridge.
Well, it felt like a DLC pack. And it's one of those things. I mean, all you need to do is look at the sales of Spider-Man and Miles Morales. Like, there are top tier AAA single player and God of War. Like, you know, there are massive single player games flying, especially on the Sony side.
But I will admit, though, they are few and far between. Is it far and few between or few and
few and far between, I believe.
Yeah, few and far between, because of the fact that they are these huge milestone moments and people do talk about them a lot when it comes to games. Mm-hmm. But they don't seem to be the ones that are rising to the top of the pack in terms of the monthly sales, the yearly sales. They review incredibly well and they are incredibly well known, but it is an industry that is dominated by multiplayer.
Well, I guess they almost by definition don't have that tail on them. Like, I mean, Assassin's Creed will sell very well over time because it has they do the different loot drops and the different microtransactions for it and stuff. But that's always the warring side of gaming. Like, I love the Guardians as a throwback single player. It feels like a late 2000s single player game, which I love.
Do you know what's really bad? And I feel bad for the writers. I feel like I'm slagging them off here. But I don't actually view the likes of Far Cry and Assassin's Creed as being competent single-player games. They're just, like, their stories are so...
They're just sandboxes. I mean, that's an Ubisoft problem, I would say.
Yeah. I don't look at them and think games. Of, like, that is what I think of when I'm trying to champion a single-player experience. I see a single-player experience like The Last of Us. It's like,
yeah, I was going to say, that's like an interesting
side. It's more
side
the cinematic. It's more the emotional. That's what I'm looking for when I talk about single-player games, not just has a single-player component.
Right. That definitely, again, that falls into the Ubisoft stuff for me, because they'll say that The Division is a single-player game, and it's absolutely not. And Back for Blood, there's a single player mode, but like it's not really anything because the AI is terrible and you can't unlock any trophies or achievements.
I tell you what, I'm playing Back 4 Blood single player, not through choice though, because I still can't get online properly to sort out my matches. Thank you very much, Xbox Game Pass, for a free game that is absolute bunk.
I mean, that's the whole thing. It is like, I would say the likes of Naughty Dog and like Sony overall pushed that idea of single player stuff being very cinematic. And like, yeah, it is an interesting conversation on what, like, can you call your game a single player if it is just the multiplayer mode with less people, with less with bots or something?
It's a real risk as well doing single player games because of the fact that when you add in multiplayer, if it's a multiplayer focused title, you get more players by proxy playing your game because it's designed around having more people online, and it's easier to sell battle passes. It's easier to sell season passes. It's easier to spend like skins and stuff like that, because what you're doing is just slotting stuff into a formula that repeats itself over and over and over and over again. With single player stuff, it's like writing a movie, then directing it, like then creating every single asset from it. There is such an intense amount of work that you can see why they're less favorable when it comes to handing out loans to make these.
If you're big business, all you want to do is do the most bankable over time thing possible. It's why you end up with the likes of the Avengers, or you end up with the likes of Anthem. But I'd love Rockstar to do a story focused game every couple of years, smaller budget, more focused on storytelling and writing and scripting and characters. I would love that stuff. I think that over time would make more money than gambling on X number of monetary platforms that fail anyway.
What I love is when you actually find multiplayer centric games that put in a single player mode that is actually banging. Like, do you remember Tony Hawk's Pro Skater Underground? Versus Eric Sparrow, mate. Like going through all those levels.
Limp Bizkit time, that, mate. That's when they were flying.
Walked into that one, didn't I? Just move on.
Well, a pair of board shorts waiting for you, but backwards red cap. Don't worry about it. Next question from Carol Type Shaw, who says, do you think Elden Ring will be peak Soulsborne? Is Soulsborne still a niche genre, or has it gone more mainstream?
If you will allow me right now to make a noise that could sum up the entire 15 to 20 minute demo that we just got yesterday, it goes like this. More please.
My reaction was the opposite of the world, where I just sort of looked at it. I'll let you should talk positive things, because we've argued a lot on this podcast. What do you think about Elden Ring?
I think that it is an open world Dark Souls game, and I am here for it, mate.
I think it's an open world Dark Souls game, and it's just an open world Dark Souls game, and I wanted
more.
Why is that a bad thing? I said I'd let you talk, and here I am. I thought that the whole, because I looked at the animations and I was like, well, the walking animation is exactly the same, and I don't like that they talk about having stealth mechanics, but they're not Sekiro style. They're like, it's almost like you're playing a stealth version of Dark Souls. Like, I love the bit when she goes behind the guy, one of the guards, and she's crouched and then just does a full bore arrow shot to the back of the guy's head. So there's no stealth takedown there at all, and the aerial kill is just jumping and doing a drop attack. It's not like an actual animation, and it was stuff like that where I was like, this feels like Dark Souls on a bigger map. And I know that's what people want, but I wish there was more bespoke animations to make Elden Ring more Elden Ring, make it more of its own thing.
I totally understand where you're coming from, because when Dark Souls, Soulsborne, Bloodborne, whatever you Sekiro stuff comes out, they big them up to be like bigger and more impressive, but it is. You could get away with the mechanics and the graphical assets being recycled in the Dark Souls game, because it is a franchise based around cyclical stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, it is about repetition and stuff. So it kind of makes sense in that, if you're going to get down to a granular level. I too would have liked to have seen a bit more flash and pizzazz to the animations there, but it's not something that's going to hold back my enjoyment. As long as it is rock hard, offers a challenge that is, tough but fair, I'm there for it. I'm really excited. And the horse riding combat,
the horse stuff looks great. Like the spirit springs or whatever they're called, where you just fly up the side of a mountain. That stuff's awesome.
The only thing that I can think of that might be a bit lessen the impact of it is the fact that everything that we saw in the terms of the combat with the horse stuff was that it just was circling around and around and around. I was like, that's what we do with every single Dark Souls boss. You just run around in circles and wait for your opportunity to attack, pretty much.
It kind of made me think it was like Shadow of the Colossus on like steroids. It was just like really brutal, punchy version of Shadow of the Colossus. And so, I mean, it looks like solid enough. It was one of those things where I was like, it's From Software. They've done a From Software. And I get like, it's barely a criticism, because it was just that thing where I watched it and I was like, I know how that's going to play. I know how that's going to feel. And when they did the different finishing animations, the different stabs, the camera shakes in the same way that it does in Sekiro. And I was just like, we've done this. Like, it's cool, but I just kind of wish there was a little bit more to it that made it more more identifiable as Elden Ring, rather than just it's another From Software game.
I mean, I did get like a lot of sort of like influences from Breath of the Wild as well, looking at it.
Other than the map markers and stuff.
Yeah, just in the way that they were presenting what this new world was going to be. So I'm very excited.
I like the idea of, you know, say you come up against some boss or something and it's just standard Souls thing of like, oh my God, I'm clearly not ready for this. And you can just go off in 12 other directions and find something else. And maybe you'll find a weapon or something that'll let you get through it. I do trust in From Software. I mean, Dark Souls is my favorite games of all time. And I love Sekiro. So it's like, okay, I have faith. I just was a little bit underwhelmed with the reuse of animations or the feel of this is literally Dark Souls on a bigger map. So I guess we'll see how it goes. Next question from Jacob Sawyer. Which studio slash company for you has completely lost their way creatively? For me, it's Ubisoft or Activision. Everything is just the same or it's refined or tweaked slightly. I enjoyed Assassin's Creed Valhalla, but it's not what I want from Assassin's Creed. And how many times can Activision repackage Call of Duty?
Yeah, you've got hit the nail on the head.
World War One is out today as well.
Yeah, I mean, for me, anything that goes into the annualized release, that's always going to end up being just like building on a crumbling empire. Mm-hmm. You're just going to add new assets or slight tweaks on the same bones, and you're just charging people the same 60 to 70 quid for doing it. I will always be very annoyed about that, is my personal bugbear. But in terms of picking one specific publisher or developer that's lost their way, I was thinking, I was going to say Microsoft, that they've lost their way. But then I was thinking only in the sense that they have bought developers and they've not used them properly. Like, goes
it
back
is
to
a
the
weird
old, like,
holding pattern
like,
for them.
Yeah, like Rare and Criterion not being able to release games that made them famous. They've like absorbed them into the greater mass and have just split up the teams to work on different things throughout the years. And I feel like at one point in time, Microsoft was... what you would only think of PC gaming and associate Microsoft with it. It was just embedded into that sort of thing, like mainly because of the fact that it was the only thing to play the games on. But now it feels like they, I don't know, they're just, they did the EA thing of the late 1990s and early 2000s, buy up a load of developers, squeeze out the last games of them, siphon them off, and then just that was it.
I can totally see the argument that it's weird because Game Pass is flying. It's an incredible value for money, but I kind of couldn't believe that we started another generation and they didn't have a slate of games ready.
Yeah.
Like, their organization is actually kind of terrible. Like, the fact that they had to delay Halo last year, a month before it was coming out, and then we're just hoping, crossing fingers, that the campaign has been brought together for this year's release. It is insane. Like, I could absolutely see the argument that you contrast, you know, the 2000s Gears of War, Fable, and the Forza, and the amount of Xbox franchises with where we are now, and some of those things are still going, but they've just, it's weird. They're just the Game Pass company. You're buying a console to get Game Pass, and that's kind of it. It is
they've
a hell
just
of a
completely
contract.
Like stepped away from the actual like development of interesting and unique things. Like, I tell you what, mate, if they'd released the brand new Xbox and they'd said that a new Viva Pinata was coming back on for it, I would have absolutely hit. I would have been mad for it.
They just needed new stuff. Like, it was just sort of like this. It's been so few Xbox exclusive franchises that got your turned eyeballs kind of thing. Psychonauts 2 is like the only one of the year.
Yeah.
Forza Horizon's about to come out, I guess, but yeah.
I'll tell you what, another developer that has completely lost their way is Konami. Like,
oh god,
the
yeah,
whole
that's been a long
debacle
time.
Of like, you know, between Metal Gear Solid Survive and their breakup with Hideo Kojima.
They have all the eFootball stuff right now. Like, that game was released years in advance. Like, that just thing seems completely broken. I'll second Ubisoft. I can't believe that they're doing X Defiant as this weird Call of Duty chasing thing. Then they tried Ghost Recon, whatever it's called, Front War, Frontline, the PUBG style thing.
Just
do a new game. Do something that's not like literally ripping off the competition. And they've announced there's the new Splinter Cell leaked, but I have zero faith that that's going to be an actual Splinter Cell. I think that's going to be like a Ghost Recon type thing. So all those and more, basically. Next question from Nod Dog, who says, another week gone, lads, and I have the hottest take of hot takes to drop. The original God of War franchise is better than God of War 2018. God of War 2018 is good, but the originals are chef's kiss. Also, scotch over a pint any day. Keep up the good work.
There's a lot to dissect from that. So the original God of War games are better than the redone.
That's what Nod Dog says. I disagree.
Listen, I can actually see where he's coming from, though, because the action spectacle that you got from the first three games alone was so incredible.
Yeah.
Like, I had never played anything quite as polished and as brutally, viscerally violent as the original God of War games. I loved going through all of the different pantheon of gods at the time and growing with Kratos as he became effectively more and more angry and his powers grew and grew and grew. Mm-hmm. Those, like, there are certain boss battles from the original trilogy that stick with me as some of the best boss battles in entirety of gaming.
Hydra like, all the way.
Yeah, like just going against Ares or like going against Zeus, like that, getting your ass kicked by Zeus was such a humbling moment.
That, the massive statue in God of War 2, the Colossus of Rhodes, that thing was insane too.
Like the fact that they managed to get that sense of scale and epicness onto the PS2 at the time was really impressive. And it was so liquid smooth as well, the combat. Mm-hmm. I can see that that is like action arcade joy condensed. But in terms of moving the conversation along from here's what a game can be in the, if you just classify it as a game versus here's what a cinematic experience with game elements attached to it, it's they're night and day projects. I feel like trying to compare them is actually really difficult because...
Although, you know, it's like it's kind of interesting because it is like it gets to the... Because for me, if I'm ranking the best games of all time, I'm not going to put something that has a an overarching... If it was like a percentage breakdown, if the majority percentage is more focused towards cinematics, I'm not going to say that's one of the best games of all time. It's going to have elements that are rooted in the medium. So like as much as I don't agree with... I agree that God of War 2018 is better overall as a package because I'd have to hang that on the gameplay and the fact that it twins the mentality that came with those old games with the how much, like you said, they advanced the conversation. But it is an interesting conversation because the older God of Wars are way more video games. Yeah. Like you said, arcadey mechanics, they're nice and snappy. They're way more like, they don't really care about gore. They're all over the place. And
well, you actually get
it
all
is
of
like
your,
a divisive thing.
You get all of the different abilities and stuff as well. Whereas in God of War 2018, you have a much more limited
you get like some
moveset.
Special powers, yeah, but it's not as much.
But they're basically all revolving around upgrading your axe or your shields or whatever stuff that you get, though your Blades of Chaos, but you get so much more crazy stuff in the previous games and so many more outrageous combos that you do. And I can kind of see that like it's more fun potentially to play through the first three God of Wars than it is to go through the emotional slog that is God of War 2018. But in terms of a more rewarding experience, because it requires more investment of the player in the latter, I think that that was what makes it a better experience. I couldn't argue that it makes it a better game because it doesn't actually do anything that we haven't seen in any other. It's got impressive environments. It's got open world elements, climactic bosses, quick time events, and combat that kind of feels not ripped off, but adapted from a principle that was set with Batman Arkham Asylum. That sort of like crowd.
Yeah, very Soulsian too, I would say.
Like that's fine. Combined, it makes a brand new experience, but on in terms of gameplay elements, it doesn't do that much new that I haven't
seen in other games because obviously both of us grew up with God of War, and I love that they wrote the new one. Obviously it was Corey Barlog who came on board in God of War 2. I think he was on a part of God of War 1, but he took over in God of War 2 to have a bigger role and everything. And I love that God of War 2018 is a reflection on the attitudes of the industry across the 2000s, that whole approach to violence that we had, the likes of Manhunt and all those sort of like shock violent games. And like you said, advancing the conversation, the conversations Kratos has with Atreus are literally him talking to his old self. Like there's a whole portion of the new game where Atreus gets carried away with his god powers and he's just killing without really caring. And Kratos has to address that. And they make that what the whole game is about. And I was like, this is a brilliant meta comment. Like it's working on five different levels and it's great. But like you said, it is one of those things where if you just want a through and through video game, maybe the old ones are like that because you don't have all that cinematic stuff. You don't have the character building. And you could argue that that is in something's favor if it's trying to be a better video game.
Yeah, I feel like I had potentially more brain dead fun with the original trilogy, but I walked away from God of War 2018 remembering much more of what I did and the impact of my choices within that game.
Oh, totally. And I think if for the originals, by the time they got to God of War 3, he was just butchering everyone and everything, friend, foe alike, and nothing landed anymore. So it's just I will take 2018, but it almost only works because of the foundation set by the original one. They needed something to bounce off and evolve from. It's the beginning of a conversation that 2018 finishes. But yes, massive thank you for everybody for sending in some of the best questions we've ever had, to be honest. Some of the best back and forths that we've had. We'll carry some stuff on to next week because it really was a brilliant selection of questions this week. And for now, this has been the Untitled Banter Podcast. Check out our Twitters next Thursday. I'm at /LP89. Jules, where will you be?
I'm at RetroJ with a 0.
Beautiful. We'll put out another a casting call, another net of questions. But I will carry some stuff over as well, because you never know. There might be more hot takes, maybe more Limp Bizkit takes. You never know.
Please no. Please,
what people
no.
are going to bring up. But for now, this has been the Untitled Banter Podcast. I've been Scott Tilford, joined by Jules Gill.
Thanks for having me, mate.
And we'll catch you next week. UBP, UBP,
UBP, UBP. UBP.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.